This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and what a week of news.
And let's begin our week in review with Senator Scott Brown. Last week, it was all about revelations about boyhood sexual abuse.
But now that his book is officially out, this week, the senator is all about moving forward.
I'm a forward thinker, and I'm trying to move on with my life. And if it happened 2 years ago, sure, I'd jump on it in a second. But it was 42 years ago.
Then midweek, President Obama does an about-face and decides not to defend the Defense of Marriage Act.
It became clear to those involved in the suit, those looking at it closely, that this statute really doesn't have much defense, that its only purpose is to discriminate against same-sex couples.
And this morning, a lightning-fast vote on unions in Wisconsin.
All in favor say aye.
Republicans suddenly closed off discussion, called the roll, and voted in a matter of like 10 seconds.
The ayes have it. The bill is adopted.
But the issue is not over, not in Wisconsin, not anywhere, and certainly not in Massachusetts, not with the big union rally that raised passions on Beacon Hill this week.
So let's send a message to the governor of Wisconsin that we're here in front of the State House, and we're here. Let's go!
Every once in a while, you got to get out of the streets and get a little bloody when necessary.
Hey, toll takers make more than I make.
Yeah!
We don't need to attack public sector workers to make change for the people of the Commonwealth.
It's the Labor Rally, not a Tea Party! Let's go! Union!
Whoa, what a week. So what do you make of all of it? What do you make of how Massachusetts is making waves in the rest of the world through the Defense of Marriage Act? With Senator Scott Brown, what's your take on how the Wisconsin union fight is shaking up politicians and public employees right here in the Commonwealth? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So with us now to suss out the light from the heat in this week's news is Renee Loth. She's a columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Renee.
Thank you so much.
And also with us is David Bernstein, political reporter for the Boston Phoenix. Hi again, David.
Glad to be back.
So let's start, Renee, right with today's news and that blink and you missed it vote in Wisconsin this morning, at least in the House side, about unions. What do you make of the fact that happened and its potential implications, if any, here in Massachusetts?
Well, I think it's a really significant moment in the history of labor law in this country. I mean, what's happening in Wisconsin, I think, is that Governor Walker there is using the deficit and concerns about budgets that all of the states are facing to push, an ideological agenda, to really undermine the, the fundamentals of collective bargaining and collective bargaining law. All of the states, Massachusetts included, have big problems with the benefit packages and wages for public sector unions. But I think what Governor Walker is doing there is, a sort of a bridge too far. And I think we saw on Tuesday with that big rally in Massachusetts a sense that most of the political establishment here is drawing a line at that.
David?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in the political repercussions potentially of this. And this is something very interesting that the Republicans have been able to draw out a lot of union votes on their side over the last couple of years. And you saw that very strongly with Scott Brown here in Massachusetts. This is why I think this is a problem for Scott Brown, that there's a lot of distinction made in a lot of people's minds between the public employees' unions and the trade unions and, that sort of thing. And the problem the Republicans can have is blurring that distinction and putting it all a sort of, worker versus non-worker, whatever, boss or whatever it is. And that, I think, is when Renee talks about the bridge too far, I think that's what has happened here. What you saw out on the common was that, SEIU, the trade union types out there in support, and that's going to put them on a very opposite side of the GOP and Scott Brown.
Well, speaking of the political repercussions, if any, here in Massachusetts, Representative Michael Capuano, he sort of grabbed some headlines, maybe inadvertently, by using some language on Tuesday that he was later a little bit sorry about. Let's listen to what he said that day.
Every once in a while, you got to get out of the streets and get a little bloody when necessary. This fight is worth it. This fight is worth our efforts. This fight is worth you measuring every elected official, every single one of them, on whether they stand with you or they don't.
So with us and against us language, and of course maybe not the ideal or choice use of words invoking blood post-Tucson, David Bernstein, is this a big deal? I mean, the cap is going to run for Senator Brown's seat come 2012.
He may very well. I really wanted to talk about this issue entirely in violent metaphors, you know, and how Capuano shot himself in the foot and, you know, and is now coming under attack, you know, by the Republicans who were firing the first volley and so forth. You know, my take on this for a long time has been that both sides react much too strongly to innocent, violent metaphor and not enough to real serious language, you know, meaning about, you know, when they're insulting each other and saying very terrible things about what the other side is going to do and so forth. And I think that's the case here, where there was very little talk that I saw criticizing the sort of with us, against us part of it,
right,
of class warfare, all about the language, which he apologized for very quickly, and I think clearly didn't mean literally.
Yeah, I think Capuano's larger sin in this case was allowing the Republicans and his opponents to change the subject. It became more about his language and the, you know, you pledged to tone down the rhetoric and now here you are, blah, blah, instead of it being about the substance of what Capuano was talking about on that whole rally, which is the attack on the public sector unions.
He did, of course, issue an apology thereafter, and I just want to read it so that everyone knows. He said, Representative Capuano said, "I strongly believe in standing up for workers' rights, and my passion for preserving those rights may have gotten the best of me yesterday in an unscripted speech. I wish I had used different language to express my passion, and I regret my choice of words." We are talking about the news of the week in review, including big union rallies on Beacon Hill. Senator Scott Brown's new book is out, and the Defense of Marriage Act does not get a defense from President Obama. What are your questions or thoughts on this week's news? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Renee, actually, before we leave the issue of unions in Massachusetts, you noted, and this all sort of caught our attention too, that Governor Patrick was at the rallies on Tuesday on Beacon Hill. He's had an interesting relationship with unions in Massachusetts. Let's hear what he had to say on Tuesday.
"We haven't agreed on everything, but you and I both know we have to have a kind of politics that says we don't have to agree on everything before we work together on anything."
So, Renee, I mean, the governor going straight at the fact that he's had a kind of a rocky relationship with some employees or some unions in Massachusetts, particularly, you know, the tea employees union. What do you make of the fact that he decided to come anyway and say, "I stand alongside you"?
Yeah, I think it was important for him to do this. You know, he is in the middle of some really tough negotiations with the public sector unions around their health care benefits and some of the other, tussled with the firefighters and with the police over the flagman issue in his first term. So he has some problems with unions, and I think it was important for him politically to go before this rally. I also think he believes that that collective bargaining is something that we're still going to support here in Massachusetts, and we're not, you know, going as far as in Wisconsin.
David, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right, and I think that he's trying to use this opportunity to show that he is essentially, you know, on the same side with the unions. It was interesting in the race against Charlie Baker. I think Charlie Baker, you know, what I was referring to before about the breaking down that difference between the public and the private, you know, employees unions. Baker, I think, really hurt himself by doing that, mm-hmm. and lost a lot of votes because he fell into that, you know, worker versus Republican Party kind of
thing. Yeah. I just want to say one last thing about public versus private sector unions, because I think this gets obscured often. It's important to remember that, you know, there's a lot of talk about these egregiously large pensions that the public sector workers are getting, and there are a few outliers, mostly from managers, frankly. But it's important to remember that people who work in the public sector do not get Social Security, and the average public sector pension is about $19,000 a year, which is about what the average.
But isn't that by the state's choice that they're not actually part of Social Security?
Well, yeah, I mean, essentially, it's part of the way that it's bargained out, that they bargained to have to They bargain pensions.
Right, but it's not like they're double dipping at
exactly.
that point.
Right, exactly. Okay. They're not getting rich.
Right. And also, I just want to add a little bit more context to that as well. I mean, because I was looking at what exactly, besides the, you know, the abandoned collective bargaining that this governor in Wisconsin wants to get passed, the other things that he's actually asking for in Wisconsin, he's asking for public sector employees there to pay between 6 and 12%, have a 6 to 12% increase in their pension contributions. Right now, they pay between 1 and 6%. Where here in Massachusetts, public employees already pay 10% of their salary to fund pension benefits, and 15 to 20% of their health insurance premiums. So in that sense, we actually are even further ahead here in Massachusetts than in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and some of those gains have been made under Deval Patrick. And frankly, you know, it's very interesting that the Republicans' talking point on this has been that we have to break down the unions, basically the public employee unions, because public employee unions have this unfair advantage in the system. They game the system because of their political influence and so forth. But actually what this whole thing has shown is that in fact the political system can work just fine, and that when the Republicans got voted into power, they asked for these concessions, and actually the union made the concessions, and the Republicans are still pushing.
Well, much to talk about there, but we've got to move on to the next really big piece of news this week, and that is, of course, President Obama deciding to not defend the Defense of Marriage Act in the Second District Court in the state of New York. Not everybody was happy about this decision. Here's Chris Mino of the Massachusetts Family Institute.
Well, we believe it's a very sad day for our nation when the president and the attorney general of the United States refuse to carry out their constitutional obligations to defend laws that were duly passed by the Congress.
On the other hand, members of Congress can choose to continue to defend this in New York. There is a case pending in Massachusetts. Renee Loth, your thoughts on DOMA or don't DOMA?
You know, it really does have very big implications for Massachusetts, the first state to legalize gay marriage. In July, Judge Toro, a federal district court judge, ruled that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional because it unfairly, unconstitutionally intruded on a core area of states' rights, which is marriage law. Because in Massachusetts, you know, we have gay marriage. Some of these gay couples were not able to get full benefits because of the Defense of Marriage Act. One of the plaintiffs who brought the case that Judge Toro ruled on worked for the Postal Service, and she was a duly married gay marriage. She was not able to get Social Security and other benefits for her partner because she was a federal employee. And so Judge Toro said that's unconstitutional under our law. And the Obama administration was appealing that decision. Now, probably the Obama administration will drop
the appeal. Yeah. David.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. It does have wide implications, and particularly because, you know, Renee sums up exactly what's at stake here. It's not whether these marriages are legal. That's a done deal. It's whether the benefits, you know, Jerry Studd's former congressman, his widower is one of the ones involved in the lawsuits because he can't get the death benefits that he's owed from the federal government. What happens now is that the Congress, the Republicans in the House, can take this up. They don't need the Senate to go along with it. They can take up the defense. They almost certainly will. And politically, there's two very important things. One is the political thing which is that the Republicans do not want this to be the front and center issue. They don't want to be seen as jumping in. Remember that when they did this with Terri Schiavo, it did not go well.
Right.
Jumping in on a social issue thing, especially to go after people's death benefits. The other thing very quickly is that in the big implications, the argument that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, made about the standard that has to be used from now on from their perspective sets the bar very high for basically to make any law discriminating against people on the basis of sexual orientation would now be very, very difficult. So it would have broad effects across a number of different areas.
You know what also surprised me, or maybe I shouldn't be surprised, was that overall, you know, the muted, if anything, response from the GOP. I mean, maybe one would think that the usual suspects, including Mike Huckabee, comes out and says, we can't believe it. But Governor Mitt Romney not a peep out of him on this. It's, you know, it seems like the gay marriage issue has kind of lost its edge even amongst Massachusetts politicians who have national ambitions.
Well, I'd like to believe that. I mean, I don't really know if we've gotten that far. I do think that, you know, the country is coming around to, you know, feel that gays absolutely deserve equal rights. But I think people like Romney and some of the others are a little bit behind that curve. One thing that I find incredibly ironic is that some of these same conservatives who have been shouting about states' rights, you know, we need to have the states have their own rights. In this case, you know, are very much against individual states being able to pass gay marriage laws. And in this case, they're on the other side of that states' right argument, and they're saying, you know, that we need to have a federal law you know, denies benefits to individual states that make their own decisions.
To be clear, the federal law does still stand, even though the president doesn't think it's constitutional. David, your thoughts on Governor Romney and him being kind of silent on this one?
Well, I'll tell you what the problem that the Republicans have is that 1 week from today, the government's going to shut down because they haven't done a continuing resolution and so forth. And if these Republicans, if John Boehner and Mitt Romney, even though he's not in the House there, if they're out there while the clock is ticking away and everybody is paying more and more attention to how are you solving this budget thing, if they're out there saying we have to go and pick up the ball on defending this DOMA Act, it is going to look horrible, and they know it. And I'll tell you that the most telling thing to me was that the first statement out of John Boehner's office, the Speaker of the House, the first statement coming out of the spokesperson was to blame Obama for the timing of raising this issue of gay marriage at the time that we're dealing with it. So trying to put the blame for the timing on Obama because they know that they don't want this to look like they're jumping in.
Well, before we run out of time, I want to talk about another Massachusetts politician, of course, Senator Scott Brown. We've heard a lot about his book before it even came out, but it did come out this week. What really got my attention was that a lot of people, particularly in the Tea Party, they on the internet were saying the sexual abuse stuff, while a sad and touching story, maybe a bad choice of word, sad story. That was last week's news. This week, they got mad at him for saying this on Fox News with Sean Hannity.
What a Tea Party
member. You consider yourself a Tea Party member?
No, I'm a Republican from Massachusetts. I'm not a Tea Party member. But what is a Tea Party member? Somebody who's concerned about the fiscal and financial future of our country? That's me. They're concerned about the overtaxation and overspending and our national security? That's me. So I agree with what they stand for.
Even on his Facebook wall, Renee, their Tea Party members were angry, calling him Benedict Brown.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think already there have been some whisperings and rumblings about Senator Brown drawing an opponent from the right, somebody from the Tea Party or somebody to the right of Brown running against him in 2012 in the Republican primary. So, you know, I don't think Brown really in Massachusetts has any, there's no benefit to him to cozying up to the Tea Party any more than he already is.
You know, David, I know you read Against All Odds very carefully and closely.
Yes.
What did you make of the fact that it seems like the reasoning that Senator Brown gave for him becoming a Republican seemed a little thin? I mean, Dan Mazzi, our producer, and I were looking back, and there's like one paragraph that we could find that said, I'm a Republican because of the 1972 Munich games, and I'm a fiscal conservative.
Yeah, I wrote about that in the Phoenix this week, the new issue that just came out. It's a fascinating book. Here's a guy who you know, is in the middle of a major political, you know, career. He puts out a book, and it basically does not talk at all about anything political. So, and this is clearly a deliberate thing. It's
but
a
don't
very
people have
smart
a right to
thing.
Also know about this man as
well,
much as he wants to, you know,
well,
tell?
Well, they may have a right, but it's not politically smart for him to tell them because he wants the people on the right to think that he's with them. He wants people in the middle to think that he's with them. He doesn't want anything that he comes out to say hurts him with somebody. So
David, I got to ask you, or does it? Or is he just getting all this stuff out of the way as early as he can so that maybe if he does have higher office ambitions, he's saying, hey, you know, you can't actually catch me with anything because it's already all out there.
I mean, I see what you're saying. You know, and of course he's a very ambitious guy. He's keeping all his options open. So yes, in that sense, yes, it gets everything out. Yes, I stole records and, you know, whatever when I was a kid. But none of that stuff, nothing that he admitted to is that bad anyway. But by concentrating the book entirely on basically up until the point where he became political, the other thing that it does, aside from masking anything about his actual politics and ideology, it also masks the fact that he has spent, you know, the last 20 years of his life as a politician, which mm-hmm. is not his image. And so I actually wrote, you know, he literally goes through his 6 years as a state representative in one paragraph. So, you know, that's smart. Well, I don't blame him for that.
I'm not sure there was more than a paragraph's worth of material there from his political career.
Well, we, in radio terms, only have a few paragraphs left till the end of this segment. And my co-host, Anthony Brooks, has been sitting very patiently and quietly next to me. Still there?
Yes,
you're
hello.
Still with
yes,
me,
thank
Anthony?
You for thinking okay. of me, Magna.
Well, I wanted to bring him back in here because it is time for our hubbubs, that the news that we didn't talk about in our week in review, but deserves a little attention. And Anthony, actually, can I start with you?
Absolutely. So here's my hubbub. It's about the latest really interesting article in Rolling Stone magazine about American military commanders in Afghanistan. You might remember a previous article by Michael Hastings that prompted the forced retirement of General Stanley McChrystal because of some outspoken opinions he expressed to the writer about U.S. policy, President Obama. Well, now Hastings is reporting that U.S. military leaders in Afghanistan have ordered a special psychological intelligence operation to win the hearts and minds of U.S. lawmakers so they would increase funding for the training mission in Afghanistan. Now, if true, this is truly bizarre because PSYCOPs, as they're known, information operations are traditionally used against our enemies of the U.S. But according to military officials in Afghanistan, this was an effort to collect information from members of Congress to somehow influence them, magically change their minds, and make them believers in the mission. It gets even weirder, though, because one of the people they were focusing on was Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, a Democrat and an outspoken supporter of the training mission in Afghanistan. So it's very bizarre. And the result of the article, American commanders in Afghanistan have ordered an investigation into these allegations. So we'll see where that goes.
Wow.
Can I just say, how do you know that the PsyCops people on the other side haven't been working on radio hosts to make you talk about it?
We're trying to win hearts and minds every day, David. Renee, your hubbub?
Thank you. Well, you know, Governor Patrick has filed a bill to return control of the Boston Licensing Board to the city after more than 100 years of it being underneath the thumb of the Massachusetts legislature. This is a long overdue correction from the bad old days of Massachusetts politics when the Yankees, who were controlling the legislature...
This is the Liquor Licensing Board,
where the Yankees controlling the legislature did not trust the Irish who were running the city of Boston, especially when it came to liquor licenses. So Governor Patrick has filed a bill to correct that. You know, I don't think that Governor Patrick is named for St. Patrick, but it could be seen as a kind of a St. Patrick's Day gift.
Oh, wow. So my hubbub has to do with, do you remember how last year after the Harvard-Yale football game, there was a group of black Harvard students that were organizing a party at the Cure Lounge? And actually, I think they sold something like 400 tickets before the event. It was sold out. But about an hour after the 10 p.m. starting time, Cure Lounge abruptly shut down the party because most of the people there were black. So it turns out that we found out this week that Cure Lounge has agreed to pay a fine, issue a public apology, and have its staff attend an anti-discrimination training in the wake of this, because it's an agreement they reached with Attorney General Martha Coakley and the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination. So
it's a $30,000 fine. It's not small change.
It's not small, but you kind of wish that they hadn't shut it down to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
But still, so some action there in terms of, you know, wow, it seems like some people in this world still believe, like, wow, a bunch of black people in a bar is a terrible thing. But that got fixed this week with the agreement with Attorney General Coakley. So, David, your hubbub.
Yeah, good for Coakley, by the way, to not let it stand their original, the nightclub's original statement, which was that we did nothing wrong. So she forced this admission out of them. So good for her. My hubbub, I have to credit my colleague at the Boston Phoenix, Chris Ferrone, who has a story in the paper this week. Like I said, we're just out about the film industry. Did I get the second plug in for my paper?
Yeah. Nicely done.
Yeah.
Wait, who do you work for?
So pick up the Boston Phoenix many, many times. As we know, it's the
cheap,
Oscars this week. It's true. You're an alum.
I'm an alum, absolutely. You know.
So it's Oscar weekend. Everyone is going to be celebrating that, you know, a lot of Boston-based movies and Boston film movies are up for awards. But my good friend Chris Ferrone writes about how things have gone sour in the Massachusetts film industry. And, in fact, there have been no films under production here for a couple of years. And there may be some sunny times up ahead. We may be turning back, but he gets into all the details. It's a very good article.
In which paper? No, I'm just kidding.
And appropriate for Oscar weekend, so people can...
And good luck to all the Boston-based movies out there, too,
absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, hopefully we will have more in the future.
They blew up the McDonald's right around the corner from my offices for one of those, for the Ben Affleck movie. So.
Oh, for The Town?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. David Bernstein, political reporter for the Boston Phoenix, thanks so much for joining us again. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you so much for being with us and have a great weekend as well.
Thank you.